From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we call journalist Nate Thayer, who's in Southeast Asia. He was the only Western journalist to witness the recent trial of former Cambodian dictator Pol Pot. Thayer says although this marks the end of a brutal chapter in the country's history, there are new troubles for Cambodia with the collapse of its fragile democracy. Also, we meet novelist Arundhati Roy. Her debut novel, The God of Small Things, has been described as an Indian Wuthering Heights. It's also gotten her in trouble at home. She faces obscenity charges. And book critic Maureen Carrigan reviews Cold Mountain, the new Civil War-era novel by another newcomer, Charles Fraser. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The space shuttle Discovery has lifted into orbit on a science mission to study the Earth's ozone layer. The shuttle took off as planned today, despite threatening weather and hazy skies. The mission is supposed to last for 11 days. The astronauts will test a robotic arm intended to perform specific chores on the planned International Space Station. This is a fairly crowded shuttle mission. There are 24 payloads aboard. And in just a few hours, the crew will release a German satellite that will study the Earth's atmosphere. Investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board have called off recovery efforts for the night at the Guam crash site of a Korean airplane. The flight data and voice recorders are being analyzed in Washington. There are conflicting reports of the number of people who lived through the crash, but at least 27 people survived the accident. Families of victims are impatient for more news. Dozens of bodies have been pulled from the wreckage. Daryl Taggarty is with member station KPRG in Guam.
They're very unhappy with the pace of the investigation, and they're upset, and the investigation is proceeding at its pace, and the survivors are not happy with how that's proceeding. They want the release of remains. And the investigators are very reluctant to release remains until the forensics experts say that it is time.
The Boeing jumbo jet crashed on approach to the international airport in Guam in a driving rainstorm. Informal negotiations between United Parcel Service and the Teamsters will begin at 2 p.m. Eastern Time today at the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service in Washington. Talks between both sides have been off since the four-day strike began. NPR's Monica Brady reports.
Today's talks are informal discussions, not formal bargaining, says Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service Director John Calhoun Wells.
It's a kind of meeting where we ask folks to check their guns at the door, to sit down, and make peace and not war.
UPS officials say they don't plan any major revisions to the proposal they made before the strike began. The president of the Teamsters said he's not optimistic about the new talks because the company hasn't changed its offer. The union wants more full-time jobs for part-time workers. The two sides were pressured to return to the bargaining table by the White House and Labor Secretary Alexis Herman. But President Clinton says he will not get directly involved unless there is severe damage to the country. UPS has lost 90% of its business since the strike began Monday. I'm Monica Brady in Washington.
There's more optimism from firefighters in Southern California. One fire official says lower temperatures and more moisture are helping with fire suppression efforts. On Wall Street, the Dow's up nearly 15 points at 82.74. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is extending yesterday's records. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
For the second straight session, computer system stocks are leading the market higher. This morning, Compaq Computer was recommended by Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrett. And Apple Computer continues to benefit from yesterday's news that Microsoft is making a $150 million investment in Apple. Long-distance telephone shares are higher after the FCC approved new rules that lower the price of international phone calls. The market is also being supported by declining long-term interest rates, which have edged lower on news that wholesale inventories increased in June by the fastest rate since the recession of 1982. I'm Doug Krisner.
The Environmental Protection Agency says fish caught in 15% of the nation's lakes, including all the Great Lakes, and 5% of the rivers are unsafe to eat. More than 2,200 advisories over 47 states are issued, and the record number of advisories is going up. These apply only to non-commercial fishing. But the EPA says that doesn't mean more contamination is seeping into America's inland waters. The EPA attributes the rise to better testing methods. Healthcare provider Columbia HCA is planning to get rid of its home health business and stop cash bonuses to workers. Columbia is radically changing the business strategy that made it one of the country's top for-profit hospital chains. Columbia is the target of federal and three state investigations of its Medicare and Medicaid billing practices. Investigators want to know if the healthcare provider has committed fraud. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen filling in for Terry Gross. Cambodia's fragile democracy was destroyed last month when Hun Sen took power in a bloody coup. That forced Prince Norodom Ranariddh, who'd been elected in 1993, into exile. Hun Sen is well known to Cambodians. He led the government through the 1980s and forced Ranariddh to share power with him after that UN-sponsored election. Cambodia is still recovering from the brutal regime of Pol Pot, who controlled the country from 1975 to 1979. His reign of terror, carried out by the Khmer Rouge, turned the country into a virtual prison camp, which resulted in more than 1 million deaths through execution, starvation, and disease. Pol Pot had been an elusive figure since his government was overthrown in 1979. He and members of the Khmer Rouge loyal to him had disappeared into the jungles of Cambodia. That all changed last month when Pol Pot faced his accusers, who denounced him for the violence he perpetrated on his country. The only Western journalist to witness this trial was Nate Thayer. He's been living and working in Southeast Asia since the early 80s. He's a correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review and a visiting scholar at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Earlier today, we called him at his hotel room in Bangkok, and I wanted to know why he was allowed to witness the trial.
Well, it's quite clear that, the whole trial, or in fact tribunal, of Pol Pot was put on specifically for me to witness. The Khmer Rouge had announced the purge and arrest of Pol Pot more than a month before. It came after a very serious internal dispute at the very core of the Khmer Rouge leadership. They'd announced it on their radio. The international community, for reasonable reasons, believed nothing of what they said. And it was necessary for them to bring in a independent, credible witness to be able to see for themselves that, in fact, Pol Pot had been eliminated from the leadership of the organization of which we know of as the Khmer Rouge.
Pol Pot had not been seen for almost two decades. Describe what he looked like.
It was really a tragic scene. It was a surreal scene. Here was a man who was responsible for the destruction of the lives of millions and millions of people in Cambodia, and who had mesmerized the world. And he was a utterly defeated, traumatized, failed figure on both a personal and political level. I felt great pity on a human level to watch him being denounced by his last loyalists in a remote jungle stronghold in one of the most inaccessible areas on the planet. It was, in fact, his final minutes. And for a man who had devoted his life to a certain vision, this was the end. And everything that he had worked for, in fact, as we were watching, was being denounced, and was being denounced as a failure. And on a human level, it was tragic.
You describe this trial as looking rather like the communist-style denunciation trials that appeared and happened during the Cultural Revolution. Describe for us what preceded, what you observed.
Well, it was a classic Asian communist, not a show trial. A show trial involves supposed lawyers and judges and so on. It was a people's mass tribunal whose purpose was to denounce and humiliate political enemies. They were crowds of hundreds and hundreds of people dressed in Chinese drab green uniforms, many of them, a shocking percentage of them, in fact, without arms, without legs, without eyes, who were victims and loyalists of the Pol Pot's vision of Cambodia's revolution, who were denouncing him.
What were they shouting? What insults were they hurling at Pol Pot?
Well, there were a series of speakers representing, again, in traditional Asian Maoist communist style, representing the intellectual, representing the farmer, representing the army, representing women who came to denounce him, who were interrupted by quite clearly orchestrated slogans. And it was quite a stark contrast, given that they were shouting slogans such as "Long live the emerging democracy" or "Long live the emerging new strategy," in clearly classic communist style, they were in fact endorsing the end of this ideology.
How did Pol Pot respond to the charges against him, the insults that were thrown at him?
Here was a man who was so traumatized that you could see that every ounce of his body, every core of his being, was attempting to maintain some semblance of dignity. He was on the verge of tears. His cheeks were shaking as in really profound psychological trauma, attempting to not break down during this process. Here was a man who was seeing his life work, his life vision, being denounced by the last of the last of his loyalists. And it was a profound moment on a human level, but it was also a historic moment because Pol Pot no longer will be ever a figure of political significance in Cambodia's future, a man who in Cambodia's past has dominated that country and mesmerized the world for many, many decades.
Pol Pot was a brutal, sadistic dictator. Did you feel any sympathy for him as he sat at this tribunal?
Absolutely. I felt great sympathy on a human level. I mean, I personally don't subscribe to the concept of revenge, and I felt great sympathy for him, for any human being who had to go through what he had to go through during those hours that day. His whole life work was being denounced, and what he had done, and what he had done, which had so terribly affected millions and millions of people, was being denounced as wrong. And for him as a human being, I'm sure that it was a catharsis. I indeed felt that there was a great possibility that given his frail physical health combined with the psychological trauma, that he may have died while we were watching him. It was this kind of historic moment.
But there are many worse fates than being insulted and having one's life work shot down and shouted down by others. I mean, it seems in certain ways that a more brutal response to what he had done would be very understandable.
Sure. And in fact, it was a great debate within the leadership of the Khmer Rouge. Remember that what we witnessed and what we photographed and what we documented through video was an event that actually took place weeks before. This was for international consumption through us. And during that debate weeks before, they had considered executing him. And they had considered a number of different options. They had chosen to let him live out his final days under armed guard and essential house arrest. And many people, I'm sure it's a natural response to seek revenge. But the larger issue is, in my mind, much more important, and that is that Pol Pot is finished, that his reign of terror, his being on the edge of politics or being in the center of politics or being involved at all in Cambodia's political future is now finished. And for foreigners, that's important. But for foreigners, obviously, justice has not been served. But for Cambodians, on a psychological level, it allows some level of closure to an issue that has affected them so profoundly personally.
You say he's under house arrest. Where is Pol Pot today, then?
Pol Pot is being kept in a house in the mountainous jungles of northern Cambodia, still controlled by the remaining elements of his organization. He is being kept under armed guard. In my view, quite clearly, he is living out the last days of his life, and we are no longer really looking at the issue of Pol Pot as a political figure. If he died in the next days, if he died in the next weeks, it wouldn't surprise me in the least.
Were you given an opportunity to interview Pol Pot?
Pol Pot, yes, the answer is yes, that the schedule was to first go through this show trial and then afterwards interview Pol Pot. But because of the trauma of the trial itself, he was literally unable to talk. He was unable to walk. He looked literally deathly ill and psychologically traumatized.
If you had had the opportunity to interview Pol Pot, what would you have wanted to ask him?
The question I wanted to ask, or the series of questions that I wanted to ask, was whether that he felt that what he had done during his years in power was wrong, whether he felt any remorse for the suffering that he had inflicted on millions of people. And that question remains unanswered. Does Pol Pot know what he has done to so many, many people who did not deserve the destruction and suffering that they have experienced because of one man, Pol Pot?
In this tribunal that you observe with Pol Pot on trial, what do you think the Khmer Rouge hoped to gain from that trial? What were their motives?
It was quite clear that the motives of the destruction of Pol Pot were rooted in the desire of the overwhelming majority of the Khmer Rouge to seek a political solution and end the revolution. They wanted a political solution because of their profound isolation, and they are seeking both domestic and international credibility and support, and to go into a tactical alliance with the democratically elected government, which is now a resistance army, to overthrow their common enemy, the Cambodian People's Party, which is in power after the coup d'etat in Phnom Penh.
You said this was a genuine trial, that it was not a hoax. What makes you so certain? And the reason I ask is that others are more suspicious of what the Khmer Rouge was up to.
Well, I didn't say it was a genuine trial. It's not a trial. It's a mass people's tribunal. It's a classic Asian-style tribunal to denounce political enemies. This kind of trial is never held. This kind of public humiliation, particularly in front of foreigners, is never held unless, in fact, these so-called enemies are in fact considered as such by those in power. There is not a scintilla of doubt in my mind, and in fact in any serious scholar's mind, on the one issue that Pol Pot has finished and is out of any position of control, leadership, or influence of any political organization in Cambodia today. There are a number of other questions. Pol Pot himself was not responsible for the killing and suffering of millions and millions of people, which raises much larger questions. Was justice done during these dramatic events last week? The answer is no. But the question of whether Pol Pot has finished and has been turned against by his own last loyalists, the answer is yes.
When you talk about Pol Pot on trial and you talk about the kind of sympathy you had for a man whose philosophy was really being shouted down, what was Pol Pot's philosophy, his ideology that he brought to bear on Cambodia?
You know, this is a question that continues to be debated by scholars even 20 years after his years in power. Was Pol Pot a Maoist? Was Pol Pot a Stalinist? Where did he get the roots of his political philosophy? In fact, what we're obsessed with, which was the brutality and the terrible reign of power that was the reality during that period between 1975 and 1979, is rooted in the brutality of Khmer political culture, the requirement for total obsequiousness to those in power, and the refusal to allow any form of dissent or debate. And these issues really are not ideological. They're rooted in political culture. When you allow communism to mix with Khmer political culture, you end up with people like Pol Pot in the 1970s, and you end up with people like Hun Sen in July 1997.
My guest is Nate Thayer, correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review. We'll talk more about Cambodia after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to journalist Nate Thayer. We're talking about Cambodia. In the early 1990s, the United Nations made an effort to rehabilitate Cambodia and spent millions of dollars to create democratic institutions. What were they able to accomplish in Cambodia?
Nothing. That money went down a black hole. The UN had elections in 1993. The purpose of more than $4 billion of international assistance was to root democratic institutions, which clearly was the goal of the overwhelming majority of Cambodians who were tired and fed up with the suffering and warfare and turmoil which has consumed them for more than 27 years. And the reaction of the international community clearly has been a betrayal. They are now supporting dictatorship. The use of armed force 3 weeks ago to overthrow the UN-sponsored and legitimized democratically elected government has resulted in hundreds and hundreds of people who have been summarily executed and tortured. It has resulted in the total destruction of a free press. All 19 opposition newspapers have fled. Many have been killed. Many are now in the jungles. Many have fled by boat, by plane, by foot to other countries. The parliament is a rubber stamp. Any kind of opposition parties have been totally destroyed. And that is the reality of Cambodia today, which is in many ways more important than the drama of what happened with Pol Pot in the remote jungles of northern Cambodia with a political movement which had been increasingly isolated and irrelevant in recent years.
Pol Pot was overthrown in 1979. There were then elections in the early 90s. Who was running Cambodia? What was the government between those two time intervals?
The government that's in power today after the coup d'etat is the exact same government which was the ex-Khmer Rouge installed by the Vietnamese invading army in 1979. They were in power between 1979 and the UN-sponsored election and Paris peace agreements. They lost the elections. They launched a military coup to refuse to recognize the elections. A coalition arrangement was made through the intervention of the international community that resulted in a shaky government that has lasted until the coup d'etat, when those that were rejected during those elections have now returned to power, and those that were elected are now back in the jungle fighting a very, very difficult civil war.
When you talk about the trial of Pol Pot and then you talk about the coup of last month, are those two separate incidents? Does one have anything to do with the other?
Absolutely. They're deeply, deeply linked. What was happening was that for many months, elements of the Khmer Rouge, not supported by Pol Pot, were involved in secret negotiations with the elected government of Cambodia to surrender. They were looking to go into a tactical military and political alliance and a united front with the Phun Sen Pek Party. After the purge of Pol Pot, because he was opposed to those negotiations moved forward rapidly. They were completed between the Khmer Rouge and Prince Ranarit's Phun Sen Pek Party on the night of the 4th of July. On the morning of the 5th, Hun Sen launched his coup. There is no coincidence here. It was because Hun Sen saw clearly that he was internally politically isolated in the run-up to elections which were scheduled to next year. It was a coalition of virtually all Cambodian opposition political parties who were in alliance with those who had won the elections against his Cambodian People's Party, and that is why the coup was launched.
Well, Nate Thayer, thank you very much for giving us so much of your time. Thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Nate Thayer is a correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review. He's been covering events in Southeast Asia, most notably Cambodia, for more than 15 years. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Out of India, a new novel of mystery, tragedy, and caste. We talk with Arundhati Roy about her debut novel, The God of Small Things. And book critic Maureen Carrigan reviews the new Civil War-era novel, Cold Mountain, by another first-time novelist. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. One of the surprise bestsellers this summer is a book written by first-time novelist Arundhati Roy. The God of Small Things is about an extended family in India, twin brother and sister, their mother, uncle, and great-aunt. The mother defies the so-called love laws by having an affair with a man who is not of her caste, an untouchable. That act of rebellion has tragic consequences for the family and provides a way for Roy to explore some powerful taboos. But that fictional relationship has also gotten Arundhati Roy in trouble in her own country. An Indian lawyer has said that certain passages in the novel involving this illicit relationship are obscene, and he wants the book banned unless the offending chapters are removed. Roy is expected to appear in court in India sometime later this month. Arundhati Roy joins us today on Fresh Air. Let's listen as she reads from the beginning of her novel set in a region called Eminem.
May in Eminem is a hot, brooding month. The days are long and humid. The river shrinks and black crows gorge on bright mangoes in still, dust-green trees. Red bananas ripen. Jackfruits burst. Dissolute blue bottles hum vacuously in the fruity air. Then they stun themselves against clear window panes and die, fatly baffled in the sun. The nights are clear, but suffused with sloth and sullen expectation. But by early June, the southwest monsoon breaks, and there are 3 months of wind and water, with short spells of sharp, glittering sunshine that thrilled children snatched to play with. The countryside turns an immodest green. Boundaries blur as tapioca fences take root and bloom. Brick walls turn moss green. Pepper vines snake up electric poles. Wild creepers burst through laterite banks and spill across the flooded roads. Boats ply in the bazaars, and small fish appear in the puddles that fill the PWD potholes on the highways.
And that's Arundhati Roy reading from the beginning of her book, The God of Small Things. I had to read that passage several times just literally to take in the lush language and just to digest what it is that you were writing about. What does it take to write a beginning of a book like that? Does that include many, many rewrites to get the words right?
Actually, no. I rarely tend to rewrite my language. You know, I don't sort of scrabble around for the right adjective. It just comes. But I think, you know, I've wondered about how you set up a novel, you know, for people. And I think for me, one of the important distinctions between writers, between good writers, is that you have, you have selfish writing and you have generous writing, where a writer actually tries to communicate, to conjure up a world in which their story is set. So to me, it was just important. It was almost like trying to communicate it to somebody that you love, that this is, you know, this is the world I'm writing about, and this is what the trees are like, and this is what it looks like when it rains, and these are the little animals that you see. And, you know, once that world exists, then the story begins to reveal itself.
How would you describe what your novel is about? It's a complex story. It moves forward and backward in time. It has a complex cast of characters. How would you distill that story for the audience?
Well, I have to say that that's one thing that I just can't do, because I sort of wager one woman war against simplification, you know. And to me, the book is the simplest way of saying what I had to say. So for me, you know, The God of Small Things is really, it isn't the story that matters, you know. It's an ancient story. It's a love story. It's a story about childhood and motherhood and intimacy and transgression. It doesn't matter where it's set. You know, the fact that it's set in India is only because that's where I grew up, and that is the territory that I know. But for me, it's a story about biology, about our biological natures.
Well, one of the transgressions in the novel has to do with the love law, and the mother in this story, Amu, falls in love, has a passionate love affair with a man of a different sect, a different caste. She's Christian, he's Hindu. And in your own life, your parents mirrored that same part of the story, as your mother was from a different caste than your father.
Yeah, that's right. My mother married it wasn't caste. It was also she. My mother's from Kerala. My father was from Bengal, and she was Christian. He was Hindu. They married, and then they were divorced when I was very young, and she came back to live in Kerala.
What was the reaction to their marriage? Had they broken the love law, so to speak?
Well, the reaction to their marriage, you know, among the sort of educated upper class, if you do something like that, and if she had remained married to him, I suppose there would not have been terrible consequences, you know. But when she left him, she had to, because of, you know, various private reasons, she comes back into the heart of this traditional community. I mean, not into the heart, actually. She lives on the edge of this traditional community, and she has children, and this community then does not allow them the assurances that it would allow, you know, people, it would give people who lived within it. So what you are is, for instance, me and my brother were growing up on the edge of this community, which meant leading a completely unprotected childhood with a very vulnerable mother as a protector.
Well, I want to have you read a passage from the book, and this is actually from the very end of the book, when Amu, the mother, is making love to this man that is such a transgression. And I should add that a man in India has said that this passage in your book undermines public morality. And you're going to have to go back in a couple of weeks and face a courtroom to defend what you wrote. But first, I want to have the audience hear your words as you read this passage.
Okay. She unbuttoned her shirt. They stood there, skin to skin, her brownness against his blackness, her softness against his hardness, her nut-brown breasts against his smooth ebony chest. She smelled the river on him, his particular Paravan smell that so disgusted baby Kochama. Amu put out her tongue and tasted it in the hollow of his throat, on the lobe of his ear. She pulled his head down towards her and kissed his mouth, a cloudy kiss, a kiss that demanded a kiss back. He kissed her back, first cautiously, then urgently. Slowly his arms came up behind her. He stroked her back, very gently. She could feel the skin on his palms, rough, calloused sandpaper. He was careful not to hurt her. She could feel how soft she felt to him. She could feel herself through him, her skin, the way her body existed only where he touched her. The rest of her was smoke. She felt him shudder against her. His hands were on her haunches, pulling her hips against his to let her know how much he wanted her. Biology designed the dance, terror timed it, dictated the rhythm with which their bodies answered each other, as though they knew already that for each tremor of pleasure, they would pay with an equal measure of pain, as though they knew that how far they went would be measured against how far they would be taken. So they held back, tormented each other, gave of each other slowly. But that only made it worse. It only raised the stakes. It only cost them more, because it smoothed the wrinkles the fumble and rush of unfamiliar love and roused them to fever pitch. Behind them, the river pulsed through the darkness, shimmering like wild silk. Yellow bamboo wept.
And that's Arundhati Roy reading from The God of Small Things. I think that's a beautiful passage.
Thank you. Well, other people don't think so.
I know. And I wonder when you wrote that passage, and even when you conceived of the story, if indeed you conceived of it in a conscious kind of way, whether you thought you would get yourself in trouble with the censorship laws in India. Did that cross your mind?
Well, firstly, yeah, I didn't conceive of it consciously. I mean, it is a story that revealed itself to me as I wrote. But there are no censorship laws in terms of actual, you know, laws when you write a book. There are in cinema and television, but not in this. I have to say that, you know, I'm always in trouble in India. So this was something which I didn't know it would be exactly this, but I was not surprised that something happened, you know, because India is a country where there can be no consensus on really important things, you know. It's a country that lives in several centuries simultaneously. And the way I look at it is that it is the fallout of literature. It's the cutting edge, you know. And for me, it's important to argue this case because that is my territory as much as it is the territory of whoever has filed it against me.
But if there are no specific laws, when you go back to India and I assume have to face someone in court, what are you going to defend and on what grounds?
Well, you see, the way it works is that a private citizen he's a lawyer, this man, he has filed against a criminal case against me in the lower court. You know, it's a district court. And when the magistrate admitted his case, it becomes like the state of Kerala versus me.
Right.
Okay. Now, I have, and what he's done is he hasn't even sort of bothered to submit the book as evidence. All he did was to photocopy three pages and say, isn't this obscene? And he submits it, and the magistrate admitted the case and sent a summons to me. Now, I have appealed in the High Court, and in my petition, I have actually quoted from other judgments. There are liberal judgments about things like this, you know, how do you define obscenity and who is the custodian of public morality? And so I'm just hoping that the High Court will quash this complaint. And if it doesn't, then I'll appeal to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Let me ask you, though, and this is something I'm sure writers like yourself would have to grapple with. If it was found that there was something obscene about this last chapter and you were asked to remove it from the novel, would you do it?
No, I would just withdraw the novel. I would not tamper with it. I mean, I would not have the choice of not removing it and continuing to have it published.
Right.
But I would not publish it with passages removed. You know, I would not allow somebody to tell me what I can write and what I can remove.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very short break and then we'll talk some more. Our guest today on Fresh Air is Arundhati Roy, and she's written a book. It's her first book, a novel called The God of Small Things. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Arundhati Roy, and her novel is called The God of Small Things. I understand that you ran away from home at the age of 18. Is that right?
That's right.
What were you running from?
Well, it wasn't that I ran away from home. I was in the School of Architecture. I was a student in third year. And I just, you know, found that I was not willing to live my life on someone else's terms. Mm-hmm. And I just said that I would earn my own living and work my way through college. And that's what happened. That's what I did.
Where did you go at the age of 18?
I continued to study architecture. I used to work in offices and, in my spare time. And I had a boyfriend who was senior to me, who was working, also in an office. We had no money and it was sort of a completely anarchic existence. Then we also were trying to, we were in trouble with our college because we were trying to form a students' union. Mm. And so we actually lived in within the walls of an old ruin, there was a squatter colony. We used to live there.
So you squatted. Did you have a tent or something that you lived under?
No, it was just a little shanty hut. Wow. With sort of mud walls and a tin roof. It wasn't so bad. It was fun. I mean, I've seen that the press tries to make this out
right.
into some tragic episode,
right.
but it wasn't. It was a group of us who enjoyed ourselves enormously and were very involved with our work. And, to be 17 years old and have nobody to tell you what to do and how to run your life is a great privilege.
Well, that's a very heady experience, too. Did you learn to be resourceful or were you already?
We had to be.
Yes.
Yeah.
You then wrote screenplays even before beginning to write this novel, and I believe even acted in some films.
Ooh, that's an embarrassing part of my life.
I assume you weren't happy with your performance then.
No.
No?
I never wanted to be an actress, but I actually, my husband, the man who's my husband now,
yes.
was making a film, and he was casting for it and, happened to see me and asked me to act in it. And I didn't have any intentions of being an actress, but I thought it was a great way to, to get sort of good seats watching how a film is made. So I did it. And I hope no one ever sees those films.
And are you going to share the name of these films with us?
No.
I can't look you up. Did you know, even as you were doing it, that I can't do this? This is something I cannot do?
Well, after I finished that film, which I acted in, I actually wrote screenplays. And one of the reasons why I don't want to make films, didn't want to make films anymore, was that I just can't bear actors,
so, oh, really?
Sort of, their egos I can't deal with. But it was fun when we were doing small films and everyone was an amateur,
right.
Then there was no problem.
Right.
But after that, it was quite, it wasn't, though we had more money to make the films, it was just not enjoyable. But I there was no way that I just had no intentions of pursuing an acting career. But I wouldn't have known that until I did it once or twice.
This summer marks the 50th anniversary of the independence of India. Are you going to mark that day, that celebration in any special sort of way?
See, when you fly from America to India, you lose a day. And the day that I lose will be August 15th. Which is, no. I have to say that in India, India's at the moment swarming with sort of BBC and NPR. And everyone else is very excited about it. But we're in India, people feel that this is a country that's a little older than 50.
Mm-hmm.
So and independence came to us in such a troubled way, you know, because it also came with the partition of the country, with 1 million people massacred. In living memory, people have lost members of their families. In living memory, it's very hard somehow it's very hard to feel one thing, you know, about independence. It's a wonderful thing, but it's also mixed with so many terrible memories. And it's something which, if you were in India now and you open the newspapers, you really have to sigh, it's so hard to feel that you're not in, one can only hope that it has to get worse before it gets better. But colonialism is a terrible thing. It does terrible things to people.
Sure.
And it didn't go away on the 15th of August, 1947.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That's novelist Arundhati Roy. Her book is The God of Small Things. Coming up, another new novelist. This is Fresh Air. First-time novelist Charles Frazier has hit the literary jackpot. The movie rights to his Civil War-era novel Cold Mountain has just been sold for over $1 million. And Anthony Minghella of English Patient fame has been signed on to direct. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says this time the hype is justified.
To tell the truth, I was leery. The word on Cold Mountain was that it was a love story by an unknown writer named Charles Frazier. The novel had snuck onto the bestseller list this summer largely through word-of-mouth raves by readers and independent bookstore owners. In a recent Newsweek profile, Frazier was described as a shy, down-home sort of guy who lives and writes far from the madding literary crowd. All of this sounded creepily close to the profile of another unknown folksy writer whose love story had blitzkrieged the bestseller lists a few summers ago. I still can't say The Bridges of Madison County without first consciously suppressing my gag reflex, so I made myself a deal. I'd dip into Cold Mountain, but if there were any sensitive, muscular heroes in it who kept musing on their own sensitive muscularity, I'd dump the book, quick. Instead, nearly an hour passed before I realized that in its first few pages, Cold Mountain had charged me up into a state of high attentiveness. A Confederate soldier named Inman lies in a field hospital near Raleigh, North Carolina, reading a moldy copy of John Bartram's Travels. His cot is next to that of an amputee whose severed leg smells like last year's ham. Despite his own festering neck wound, Inman is consumed by thoughts of desertion. He plans to walk clear across the state to reach his home on remote Cold Mountain. The Civil War has been raging for 4 years, and Inman is weary, apathetic, and yearning to see a woman named Ada, whom he had to leave before their relationship clarified. The succeeding chapters alternate between Inman's Ulysses-like odyssey of return, dodging capture at the hands of the bounty-hunting home guard, and Ada's solitary battle against starvation on the Cold Mountain farm she inherited from her father. After her father's death and the farmhand's desertion, Ada, a young lady who's been prettily educated in Charleston, realizes that she could not even weed a row of young bean plants. Ada's options, as she sees them, are to sell the farm for a pittance and return to Charleston, where she would have to politely sponge off friends, or negotiate a marriage with one of the aging and ineffectual leftovers of Charleston society. She's rescued by the appearance not of Inman, but of Ruby, a work-hardened young woman who teaches Ada how to bring the farm back to functional life. Together, these two women chop down trees, kill chickens, make hard cider, cure tobacco, and in general, make Martha Stewart look like a mere do-it-yourself dabbler. In Ada and Ruby's narrative, Frazier does a rare thing. He makes the struggles of the women waiting at home feel every bit as exhausting and dangerous as the adventures of their menfolk away at war. It's Frazier's elegant, precise writing style, his focus, for instance, on every detail of how desperate people would go about sifting salt out of a smokehouse dirt floor, that lifts Cold Mountain out of the category of ye old fake historical fiction and into a realm where even the most minor descriptions and characters feel authentic. Frazier grafts his considerable research onto a great, old-fashioned, multi-layered narrative. I've never had the quintessential summer experience of sitting around a campfire listening to a musical storyteller spin yarns, but I imagine reading Cold Mountain comes pretty close. This is the kind of novel that affects your mood for days and days after you've read it, that makes you feel the life passing around you is a simulacrum, and that instead the intense fictional lives you've read about are real. And I'll confess, unlike the end of The Bridges of Madison County, the end of Cold Mountain did make me cry.
Maureen Cargan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Cold Mountain by Charles Frazier. Today's show was produced by Joan Tuohy Westman. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Alan Tu with Monique Nazareth. Research assistants from Sarah Scher. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.